Hello, and welcome to Her Music Academia, the podcast. I'm your host, Lydia Bangura. This is a music research show where I talk about all different types of music through the lens of music theory and music history. And I'm documenting my progression as a music PhD student at the University of Michigan. I'm also an active performer, so I'm a soprano, I do classical music, art song, and opera. And I do this show where I talk to musicians all about what they do in music. I feature interviews with music scholars, performers, producers, composers, conductors, you name it. And today on the show, I'm so excited to feature a conversation with Dr. Patrick Nicholson. He's a professor of musicology at the University of Alberta. We chat all about his musical upbringing, he has experience as a guitarist, we chat about his time in grad school at the University of Toronto, and we get into his research all about minimalist music. Particularly, we do a deep dive into his book that came out earlier this year, titled The Names of Minimalism: Authorship, Art Music, and Historiography in Dispute. The link to his book and all of the other books that we mention will be in the show notes. Without further ado, here's our conversation. All right, hello everyone, and welcome to this very special episode of the podcast. I'm so excited to talk to my guest today. We're going to get all into minimalist music, which is something that I don't really have a lot of experience with. So these are some of my favorite podcast episodes where I really get to just dive into something that I know nothing about and talk to the expert about it. So we are going to talk to Dr. Patrick Nicholson, who's a professor of musicology, I assume,
yes,
at the University of Alberta. Okay, great. Patrick, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. I'm super excited to talk to you. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being willing to speak to me today and for sending me your book. Yay! Now I just own a cool book. So listeners, if you're listening, if you've written a book that's about music in any way, send it to me. Send me an email, hermusicacademia@gmail.com. Please, let me read your book. So Patrick, I normally start off each episode by talking about how I met a guest or how I came to be introduced to them or familiar with your work. I have to admit, I don't remember. Is it that we just added each other on Instagram? Did we meet at a conference or something?
I don't think we did. I think I was following your podcast. And as I said to you before, you know, I don't listen to a lot of podcasts. So I've heard a few, but it's not like I'm not a religious fan or anything. You, I think, posted on Instagram that you were wondering if anybody wanted to do the show. And I responded and you said, sure. And then the press is very generous with offering free copies for people who might do reviews or might do publicity. And so, and it's the press at your university, you're at Michigan, right? So yeah. I think it was just as so many things to me are, at least since the pandemic, I think, you know, I feel almost as if I kind of know you, even though I've never met you, but it's just like social media, you know, it's like you can develop, somewhat real knowledge of someone through their social media. And it's, I think, less weird than we used to imagine it to be like, I kind of know that person.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good to know. I'm glad I wasn't tripping, because I was like, did I meet him at a conference and I'm completely forgetting and I'm about to embarrass myself being like, we've never met. And you're going to be like, no.
I don't think we have. No, not that I recall either.
You're gonna be like, except when I shook your hand at that conference, Lydia, and then I'm mortified. No, okay, that's good to know. Yeah, that we just connected over Instagram, and then, and then I guess the rest is history, or the rest is now. So glad to finally virtually be able to meet you.
You too.
So let's start off by talking about you and a bit about your musical background and history. So if you would inform me and the listeners where you're from and the music that was happening in the place where you're from and the time that you were born. So if you come from a musical family and what music in your family looks like, all of that stuff.
Sure, of course, thank you. So I'm from a pretty deeply unmusical family. I think I'm a medium unmusical person myself. I kind of take a bit of joy in sometimes working in the field that I do. I grew up in quite close to Michigan, in Windsor, Ontario, which is kind of like right across the river from Detroit. And so I grew up there and My family is like super distant, like late 17th century, like French farmer settlers in that area. So my mom's family's been there forever and ever and ever. And I went to university my first year for guitar at Wayne State in Detroit.
Okay, so when did you start playing guitar?
I skipped that part. Yeah, I guess I was like 12. I'm a guitarist, and I started playing as about 12, and I kind of got like a guitar. And started playing and started taking lessons around then.
And what type of music were you playing or interested in?
I was initially kind of learning just like rock. I remember the first lesson I learned Come As You Are by Nirvana. And so it was like, you know, I was learning rock by tab and stuff. And then at some point, someone I knew in high school, I heard them play classical guitar and I got super interested in how like hard it seemed, I guess. And so I started taking classical guitar lessons when I was like 16 or 17, and started doing, we have the Royal Conservatory of Music in Canada. So it's kind of this whole like graded curriculum that you kind of go through with a book for each grade and you do examinations. And I did all that. And then when I went to university, I went to Wayne State because they had a good guitar program. But as much as it's only like a 25-minute drive to downtown Detroit from my parents' place, it ended up costing like so much money. Like the tuition with the conversion in 2005 was super high.
Yeah,
I was paying tons for parking. I couldn't bring food across the border, so I was often buying like two meals a day. I was having to cross at like 7 a.m. to get to oral skills for like 8:30 or whatever. So after the first year, I felt like I just gotten into so much debt that I changed my mind and went back to my hometown school, which is the University of Windsor. And part of that was also that I decided after that first year of guitar that I didn't want to major as a Bachelor of Music. Because as a guitarist in most schools that I'm aware of, you kind of need to do choir as your ensemble. And I felt totally out of my depth and unpleasant and unjoyful
having
to sing
in
choirs.
What? Yeah. We need to unpack this. Why?
Maybe it's not true anymore. Yeah. So, I mean, University of Windsor had only maybe 5 or 6 guitar students, so there wasn't a guitar ensemble. And since guitarists tend to play in, you know, like symphonies or orchestras or bands, most often the choice, as far as I knew, like at least in 2005, was that most schools you ended up being in choir for your ensemble credits. Ooh. So I really didn't like the fact that I had to do like choir every term. So I did a BA in music instead, which was kind of like a build my own humanities degree.
Sure.
With my music happening outside. And then I ended up getting very involved with kind of free improvisation through a really wonderful professor called Brent Lee, who's a composer in Windsor, who had this group called Noise Border, where we kind of did like free improv and pieces that we wrote for each other. And that just kind of opened up the whole like new music, drone, noise, free improvisation kind of world to me, which then became like a big research interest. Mm-hmm. So for grad school, I kind of put aside performing entirely and started writing about experimental music and noise music. And I think I kind of learned a lot from that Noise Border group about kind of like collective politics and collective practice and bands in the kind of experimental music world. And that kind of became, I think, eventually my book project. Years and years later, after going to University of Toronto and stuff for all my grad school. And yeah.
Okay. So you went to University of Toronto for a PhD or for a master's, both?
Master's and PhD. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And you did musicology for both?
I did. Yeah. Again, there were some weird things too, because I did like, I think mostly ethnomusicology courses in my master's, and that caused some questions. I have a real taste for kind of being like slightly displaced from like disciplinary, you know, standards. Maybe I feel it like more of a strong thing than it is, but I kind of enjoy it. So there was kind of a question as to whether my master's should have been ethno or musicology, because I was doing most of my coursework in ethno, but I signed up in musicology and they gave me musicology. So but it was great. Yeah, Toronto is amazing as a city and as a school, and met so many people and had a lot of really great experiences with my cohort. We were all like best pals, and we had a professor who the first day of our grad student summer PhD seminar, like, he was like, what's less important today is, you know, the actual class content and more that you all hang out. So we left after about 20 minutes and went to a pub together and like just all became friends from day one in our PhD cohort, which again to me has been just like, you know, one of the more profoundly important, I think, pedagogical examples of my life. It doesn't need to be a pub, you know, but it could be, let's all go for a walk or a coffee or whatever. And that lots of the learning happens there rather than reading through the syllabus beginning to end together, whatever it might be.
Wow. Fantastic. Yeah. I'm glad to hear that you had a good experience in grad school. So thank you for sharing all that.
Yeah.
So let's talk a bit about then what you're doing now. So you are at the University of Alberta.
I am.
And you just got there this past year?
I started here July of last year. So it's been just over a year. Yeah.
Okay. So how's it going?
It's amazing. It's a really, really exciting department in here, kind of like in the academic music area. There's only like three of us in musicology in particular, but we're all really in agreement kind of interpersonally and professionally about kind of our priorities. And so we're big on doing like collaborative work. My colleague Fabio Morabito and I are kind of talking about a book project together based on kind of some of our work. And then I have, after we talk, I have a campus radio show with my other colleague, Brian Fotu. We do like a campus radio program every Monday. And so it feels like it's a really generous, welcoming community kind of environment here. And the grad students that I haven't met many of the grad students yet in my first year, but I'll have some this fall. And they're all really wonderful that I've met so far. And I'm very, very new to this part of Canada. I lived always in Southern Ontario and then briefly in the Maritimes, and now living out in the prairies, it's like, it's kind of a wild shock that a place so different environmentally and culturally and like whatever it is, 5,000 kilometers away is the same country. Like it kind of makes no sense. At a state colonial kind of level, it makes no sense.
Sure, sure.
But people here are super generous and welcoming. And Edmonton's a lovely city. So I'm very, very, very grateful still. I'm still in my like super honeymoon phase with it after having been looking for a permanent job for 5 years. So it's nice.
Wow, fantastic.
Yeah.
And tell us a bit about like the curriculum there, things that you're experimenting with pedagogically.
So the curriculum is kind of up and changed because there was a massive kind of restructuring of the university as a whole in 2019 that related to lots of budget cuts and stuff. And a lot of the longer term, really amazing musicology faculty that were here to that point kind of took either early retirement or changed schools. And so there was kind of a moment there where there weren't really any like conventional traditional musicologists. And so Fabio and I, as kind of the two like art, music, musicology people, are kind of rethinking what it is that we want students to do. And so a lot of that for us has to do with each taking half of the two-part history survey and really then developing it in conversation between the two of us, trying to prioritize teaching students to like read and write and listen and think and not so much about kind of the more classic canonic chronological concerns. We're hoping that kind of the two of us being in collaboration and in conversation will be something that students kind of learn from and are interested in. That's kind of the only two required courses in musicology is kind of a two-part survey. Other than that, they have a lot of variety of classes to take. And so Fabio's doing something on cultures of romanticism in the fall, and I'm doing a class that's new called Writing About Music, where it'll mostly be kind of like writing. I think we'll kind of do a different kind of genre or style or, you know, form of writing each week, including like text scores and fiction and poetry and those kind of things. But also I think we're going to spend like most of each class like doing peer editing and learning how to kind of, you know, give supportive, critical, helpful feedback to your classmates. And again, trying to kind of like foment that same kind of like cohort solidarity that I was lucky enough to experience at Toronto, because I think it's hopefully part of what helps grad students get through in a healthy, successful way is knowing their classmates like have their back and are their friends and their encouragers and not, I've always studied and worked in Canada. I don't mean to be mean to the States as a whole, but I think there's a sense in Canada that American schools can be a little more, you know, kind of cutthroat or a little more intense and also a lot more expensive. And so I think it's just trying to really hold on to those parts that are best about, interpersonal relationship and sharing and solidarity and mutual aid kind of things. And so I shouldn't have been mean to the States that way. I'm sure it's lovely. It's just kind of, you know, the general, like,
you know, I think we all have sentiment. Our critiques of the States, so I'm gonna let you have that.
I have mine of Canada too. One of the few things I'll give it credit for is, you know, like public universities and
troubled
public health care, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, that sounds like a really exciting program, and I'm glad to hear that you are enjoying your time there.
Yeah, it's been amazing so far. Thank you.
Yeah, I'd also love to circle back to kind of your experience as a guitarist and ask, so do you still identify as a guitarist? Do you still perform in some capacity?
I do not identify as a guitarist. I think I probably should, you know, like it's one of those kind of things where it's clearly like there's a bit of a hang up I have around it. I think that becomes obvious to me whenever I talk about it. I don't know. I like to think I was like pretty good at it at a time. But I always really hated performing. I think that was kind of the main thing. The first time I ever played was like a high school talent show with two friends. I had my back to the audience the whole time. And my music teacher gave me like some grief over that, that I, you know, how rude that was and how inconsiderate that was. But I was just like terrified to turn around. And so I think that kind of was like an early, you know, negative experience. And then as a classical guitarist for years, I perform in like recitals and examinations and stuff. And I always hated it. I always felt like it was just kind of like a fun personal practice in a sense. And so I've been trying to kind of start remembering that again, that maybe there's something that's just like a personal fulfillment in it that I should start practicing and working on regularly. The one time I ever really enjoyed it was playing in like dark black box rooms with like five people where we were like doing noisy free improv and no one knew where to look. And you know, I enjoyed that kind of thing. So I do miss that again. And I, now that I'm living somewhere permanently here in Edmonton again, and I'm meeting musicians in the community and I'm meeting performers here, and there's a really cool like kind of experimental noise music scene here in Edmonton, and I'm thinking I should try to find my way back into that kind of thing again. So I have hangups for sure. I just don't like performing. I really don't enjoy it. I don't like a room full of eyeballs on me, and for some reason it doesn't bother me like lecturing, but performing it always did.
See, this is really interesting because I don't want to do the whole like, you just haven't had my steak situation. But, you know, right when I hear, you know, that someone is starting their undergraduate career or whatever in guitar in particular, there are a few instruments that really pop out to me as just not well designed, like those programs tend to be, right? When you get to that. So as you were talking about when you started and you kind of were like, this isn't for me, or it's a bit too rigid, because we don't accommodate a multiplicity of styles and genres, especially when it comes to an instrument like guitar. And so like, were you mostly doing classical guitar when you were studying it in school? And do you think that that's maybe a reason why you felt like it wasn't a good fit? Because you clearly have an interest in like other genres and styles of playing.
I think so. Yeah, you're probably right. Like it's like maybe, I mean, there are so many programs where the guitar program is like deeply well thought out and they're important departments. But it's probably true that in a lot of schools that are either kind of band or orchestra directed, as a
the guitar kind of really core, falls often through the cracks.
Yeah. And so there, I'm sure there is some truth to that. I mean, I did enjoy the classical guitar like repertoire at a time. And so I enjoyed playing that. But yeah, I think it was the fact of that kind of need that the ensemble I had to be in was kind of like one of those afterthoughts.
Yes.
But also I got really super lucky in that working with that composer at Windsor, Brent Lee, like I was it wasn't guitar credits, but I was invited to do performance and to do composition and stuff that was based around like my electric guitar and tons of pedals and noisy stuff. And so having Brent there was a really lucky accident that kind of gave me like a curriculum that introduced me to a whole other field that I think already had me thinking in, you know, third and fourth year about the kind of exclusions from what we learn in music schools and kind of what falls, again, like not like fully like excluded, refused outside of it, but it's kind of like just far enough outside of the structural assumptions that you kind of notice. I think that had me thinking about that like already in undergrad, which is I'm glad for. So I mean, there are way worse ways of being far more excluded from music programs,
sure,
as I think we all know, but I think it just gave me that slight perspective on it that made me kind of resent them from the first day I joined all of them.
Yeah, and I really appreciate what you brought up as far as the experience of performing being so different depending on the context, and you gravitating towards maybe not necessarily performance in a more traditional sense, in that there's a big audience and you're in the front and you're facing them and there's this, you know, a lot of unspoken or spoken rules about how that dynamic is supposed to look, but maybe other spaces where you feel that are more intimate or whatever, where there's more familiarity or comfortability. And what I think, you know, this has been a kind of a theme that keeps popping up for me as I'm recording the episodes for this season is, you know, when we're talking about music, especially like music histories, we're often talking about a history of composition or a history of you know, exceptional performers, right? It's a history of exceptionalism. And we don't ever talk about the regular or the amateur moments that happen in music making. And so we don't talk about everyday people and, you know, Christopher Small musicking, like that there's multiple ways of participating in music. And we don't talk about those like smaller, less exceptional moments. And so perhaps relieving some of the performance pressure by making those moments, quote unquote, less exceptional or less, you know, can make it a lot more enjoyable and not imbued with all of that pressure, maybe. I don't know. I'm projecting.
I hope so.
Now. Let me not project.
No,
on you, but
well, do you feel? No, please do. Do you feel that way? Do you still perform?
I do. I mean, cool. Yes. So I am a singer. I got 2 degrees in vocal performance, and so the classical mold has always fit me. I originally started as a violist, and played viola for like 10 years, and then switched to voice, and so I've always kind of been in the classical music world. And so school and conservatory, that kind of conservatory model always worked for me because I am really steeped in the classical world, and I still perform. I'm a soprano. I'm an absolute diva. I love to perform. Yeah. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
So, right. But I recognize that I'm, you know, kind of fitting into a mold that in some ways works really well for me, works really well for my neurotypical brain, works really well for, you know, like, so there are advantages there and privileges that I have access to because I identify as a classical performer. But yeah, I recognize, especially through doing this podcast, like how many people I've talked to where they were like, I just didn't want to do that genre, that structure didn't work for me, or you know, performance in this rigid way that we're discussing it didn't work for me. And so I had to switch to a BA, or I had to drop out entirely, or I had to switch schools or figure out something that worked a bit better for me. So yeah, I don't know how to land that plane, but
it's cool though too. Cause I mean, again, to me, like I happen to be in a small school with a professor who was on board to support me. I'm a white dude in these departments. There's kind of ways of moving through those privileges too. But I think the interesting thing that I learned from all that even too is just that, like, I think what always strikes me is how much all of these, there's so many conversations in our field about how do we make music programs, you know, how do we get more students into them, or how do we make them more diverse, or how do we make them bigger, or how do we get their funding back in place, or whatever. And it always kind of just blows my mind that like we teach music. Like, people like music so much. Like, almost everyone's super into music. I think it's a weird thing that we have such a hard time selling that. And it always makes me just feel like we inherently must obviously be the problem. And we can't identify, you know, everyone or accuse everyone. I mean, like, we're selling a deeply, like, profoundly loved, you know, product to make it crass that way. And to be like, 19-year-olds won't take our classes. It's like, well, then what's wrong with our classes?
Exactly. Yeah.
People are super into music. It should be a pretty easy pitch. And so actually one of the classes I'm teaching this fall too, I didn't mention the kind of other particular things, but I'm doing our Music 101 class, which is just like non-majors arts credit.
Great.
On kind of like, I mean, it's meant to be on Western art music. I'll be mushy and critical with that a little bit, but I mean, like, it's 100 people in a room. And like, if I can't convince a few of them that maybe music studies is a thing they can be involved in, you know, just because they didn't start playing guitar or violin when they were 10 doesn't mean you're not welcome here. And we somehow still project that image that if you haven't started, if you are being like smashed on the fingers by a piano teacher when you were 5, you're somehow not welcome in the room when you're 19, which is to me really, really bonkers. So yeah,
and that's because we teach music as exceptionalism, like as these incredible moments of the masters, you know, being inspired by God and writing this great music, and then these incredible performers performing this music. We don't teach music as a practice. We don't teach music as an accessible practice that anybody can practice, whether or not you're going to perform it in front of a big audience or whether or not it's going to be seen by anybody else at all. Like, we just don't teach it as a method, like as a practice.
Yeah, people can practice and probably most often are. Like, I taught the second year version of that class, Music 201, last semester, which was like only about 25 students, much smaller and like kind of a little more in depth on kind of critical thinking about listening and identity and politics and stuff. And like nearly every student in that room like makes music. Like they some of them were like really into making beats and doing production stuff. Some of them kind of perform like in bars, open mic kind of stuff. Like they just, it blows my mind. Like every student on, when I say every, a very high percentage of students on most campuses are super into music. I think we should have a, if we're not being able to get at least some percentage of them in a class sometimes, we're offering something that needs to give its head a shake.
Yes.
I'm trying to say all these things without being like too damning. I mean, so many people on the field are doing such amazing work in this exact way. So it's not like but you know, it's that kind of like surface level palpable sense that something could be a little easier for all of us.
Yes.
Or something, you know?
No, I completely agree. So now I'm so interested in you as a guitarist. Have you ever thought about...
it's like therapy now. This is great.
I'm so sorry.
No, I love it.
All right, Jair, cut all this out. No, I'm kidding. Okay, so also, so have you, if performance never really appealed to you, or performance in this very limited sense that we are referring to it as, did you ever think about teaching guitar?
I taught guitar like all through school.
Oh, great. Okay, so how was that experience?
Great. I loved that. I mean, it was awesome. I think again there too, it's like, it wasn't performing. It was like one-on-one, half hour a week, like, you know, learning and conversation and mentorship with like people ranging from 4 or 5 to 50. And I really enjoyed that. That felt to me fun. And at that point too, I was super into guitar. So I was like, you know, I was playing well enough that it was responsible of me to be teaching it and stuff. It was kind of after that period of teaching for 4 or 5 years. Like by the end of that, I took a year off after my undergrad before I went to Toronto. And that year I was teaching like, I think 4 nights a week, 6 or 7 hours a night or whatever.
Wow.
So it was like my job that year I was off before grad school, that and bartending. So yeah, I mean, I always enjoyed teaching, but again, I think maybe like, it's like some anxiety around the kind of like ears people give you when you're playing for them versus when you're just like in a conversation. Like, this doesn't make me nervous to talk to you or to something about if you asked me to like start playing guitar, I would shrivel, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that is always the question, is, you know, how long or how much do you have to be playing an instrument or singing or practicing in order to be able to say I'm a guitarist or I'm a musician, and how far away do you have to quote unquote drift kind of from it before you don't get to claim that label anymore? But I mean, for you, it sounds like playing guitar was a formative experience for you. And so I
that's fair.
Think, again, I'm projecting, I'm like, I think you're a guitarist, but you know,
thank you.
But I understand that those hangups of how to self-identify, like, do I still identify as violist? Not really. Even though I played for 10 years and I also taught lessons and da 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 da, but it was like, you know, several years ago. So it is a weird, it is a conundrum to think about.
To self-identify. But it's a cool thing. It's, I mean, it's like how music plays in these really complex ways into our like identifications and disidentifications and misidentifications and whatever else with it, in all its capacities. Like, you know, it is like, does the fact that I don't consider myself a guitarist mean that doesn't mean I'm any less musically inclined or involved? It's just like, I don't spend my time. I guess I have a real attachment to the idea that you are what you do, you know?
Right.
And like, I don't spend like the number of hours I spend, not even weekly or monthly, but like yearly playing guitar is like, you know, one hand or less. And so to consider myself that would feel just a bit dishonest to myself, I guess. But I'm gonna go home and play guitar tonight. Thanks for the prompting.
No, but yeah. That's the thing. It's like, dishonest to who? Like, I have qualms about that I'm trying to wrap my words around. But like, who is policing that? The whole like, you are what you do thing, that feels like a very conservatory mindset thing to me. Like, if you're not practicing, you know, 5 hours a day, do you get to claim, like, at least I very much grew up in conservatory environments. And so I have it really ingrained. Like, if I don't do my scales every day or I don't do my practicing every day, then that means that I'm not a real musician, whatever that is. And so, you know, the self-policing of you have to play this many hours or this much in order to qualify, like, who's policing that? We're all self-policing.
Yeah, the self-policing is for sure the case. I mean, it's like, I spend a lot of hours a day like cooking or walking my dog or reading books. I still consider myself a musician for sure, but you said, do you still think of yourself as a guitarist? And I was like, how long have you been talking about this? And here we are. Yeah, that's that was essentially the answer. Like, it's funny, but it's true. I don't often talk about this anxiety about this for like at this kind of depth. And so it's I'm not laughing at the question. I'm saying like it's you know it's like it's complicated.
It is complicated.
Old, like, and now relationship tag.
And I have revealed that I have the same anxiety about Viola. So, you know, yeah. We're in the same
there's
boat.
There's no internal like conservatory cop in my head though. It's not that. It's just like, I just don't think I am.
Okay. Let me stop grilling you about guitar. All right. Last thing.
No, I enjoyed that. Thank you.
Yeah. Last thing before we move on to talking about your book. I would love to know if you have a piece of advice related to being a grad student, so anything related to writing for the first time, reading academic texts for the first time, developing a dissertation topic, and or teaching for the first time. So anything that you would say to your younger self or to perhaps a grad student who's going through the motions and questions it daily.
Absolutely. I have several. I mean, I'm not that far removed from grad school, always in my head, so I don't want to sound like I'm like, you know, setting down anything that's like definitive, but this is the things that I think of that some of them I've learned since and some that I learned while I was in grad school. And so the one I kind of already mentioned is I think that being close with your cohort as much as possible, as much as everyone is, you know, healthy, agreeable personalities, I think is really key. Because I think having, and this I think carries on just in a life of any kind of writing, but having somebody that you know, if you've written an abstract or a chapter or whatever, you can just like send it to them. And they'll maybe not drop everything, but get back to you in a day or two with some supportive suggestions, I think is really, really key and essential. I think one of my favorite like final stage dissertation comments was from my advisor, Sherry Lee, who she was pretty insistent in those kind of like last moments of like final touches on my thesis. She was like, this isn't your first professional piece of writing, it's your last student piece of writing. And I think of that a lot now whenever I talk to grad students that like, you know, the kind of, we all put so much of our heart and life and everything we have into our thesis. But I think hopefully at a certain point when it's like solid and you trust it, it's probably fine. You know, like you can probably kind of like lose months more or years more or some of your well-being thinking it can be perfect and it'll never be perfect. And I can tell you too from, you know, like years on the job market and like academia.edu professional subscription and stuff that like no one reads a dissertation. You know, it's like it's people read it, of course. People have read mine, it's been read, but like
sure, but
I just think it's, you know, it's something you're doing to prove you can do it as much as it's something that's published and this I'm sure some people hearing this will be like, you know, throwing something at the wall, but I think there's something like humbling of that kind of stuff, reminder that like it's your last student piece, most importantly, you know. And then I had another one, but I just forgot. I don't know. Oh, I was thinking another piece of advice that Sherry gave me that I'm always grateful for too, is that she was really insistent when I was first starting to kind of like, you know, think of all these dozens of things I might want to keep thinking about and studying. I was kind of trying to like think of and engage in like things that were like current, hot, like disciplinary themes and concepts. And she was like, don't worry about that. Write what you're interested in and what's honest to you, because what's current and immediate in the field by the time you're done will be different or changed. Yes. Or new or whatever, right? And so there's of course ongoing, you know, necessary long-term things like canon critique and kind of questions of like racialization and the histories of white supremacy and all these kind of things that are not going anywhere. But I mean, you know, there's certainly those things that are like the topic in the air of the AMS or whatever that, yeah. I think her advice was to say, you know, don't rethink your thesis because it'll be 4 years or three years or whatever. Mm-hmm. And by then that won't be what everyone's talking about. Mm-hmm. So I think that's all to say, not to again internalize a cop. It's just to say, you know, follow what you're interested in because it'll help you actually finish. Mm-hmm. And maybe it'll be what everyone's talking about by the time you finish or something, you know? Yeah. Trust yourself, I guess, is the advice.
All right, so let's move on to talking about your book, which is called The Names of Minimalism, Authorship, Art, Music, and Historiography in Dispute. And it came out earlier this year, you said?
Yeah, January 2023.
Great. Very exciting. Congratulations. Yeah. And thank you again for sending it to me. I'm glad that you have the opportunity to kind of send it out to a few people to get some reviews and stuff.
You have a public platform. You get free books and you get to talk about them.
Listeners, yeah, have I made it? Am I famous? Oh my gosh. So first, let's go ahead and kind of break down generally what the book is about and the name of the book. So first, very big question, but let's talk a bit about your definition of minimalism or how you're kind of discussing it in this book.
Yeah. So my definition of minimalism, I think it, we could either say it kind of goes undefined in the book or that it goes pretty, it kind of refuses to be set in one particular place.
Yes.
If that's fair to say. Mm-hmm. I think the most concise and specific kind of offering I do in that direction is that I use the name early minimalism in a variety of kind of brackets and bracketings and italicizations and stuff, that which comes from the artist and the filmmaker and the composer and violinist Tony Conrad, who released this album in, I'm blanking on my years, it's been a while since I've looked back at my notes, but like in the late 90s, a box set called Early Minimalism Volume 1. I never got a sense from him whether Volume 1 was meant to be kind of a joke or whether it was thought to be a series, but only Volume 1 happened. But he was a member of this drone ensemble called the Theater of Eternal Music that was with Lamont Young and Marian Zazela and John Cale and others. Terry Riley was involved briefly. And so what Conrad was doing with that CD, Early Minimalism, was suggesting that there was this kind of like early thing that drone group was doing where the point of the music wasn't so much the drone, it was more the fact that they were like in collaboration every day, hanging out together. The drone was kind of a byproduct of the choice of not wanting to have a composer, that they could kind of deliberatively choose what they would play if they each were just holding a note or two or three. And so his whole view of it was that they were trying to just remove and deny the role of a composer in general. And this kind of came out of a dispute with Lamont Young, where Young is, you know, very much of the strong author, romantic composer kind of mindset of, I wrote that, it's mine, I did that. All those guys that say we were collaborating are wrong or lying, or they'd had, you know, too much mescaline that day or whatever it might be the case. And so Tony's Early Minimalism box was about saying, it was kind of a joke to say it was early, but also saying that there was kind of this like political impetus that was prior to what we think of as minimalism.
Right.
And so I kind of use that name to launch the idea that what I'm interested in minimalism isn't so much a more precise or more scientific definition of minimalism in terms of like formal criteria, like stasis and gradual process and drone and diatonic harmony, but that I think what actually coheres what we call minimalism is more kind of disidentification with classic ideas of authorship, that most of them were in very close collaboration and that they were working together and refusing to write scores most often, that they made their own bands so they could develop things in rehearsal. All these kind of criteria that to me make the story of minimalism kind of hold together. But then why I call it early is that we kind of refuse all those more political interpersonal criteria and pretend that it started about some idea about diatonicism or things that you could like find latent in a score and analyze out. And so that's kind of the idea of early minimalism in the book. But then I also take this kind of annoying pleasure in being like early minimalism, capital M minimalism, bracket early bracket minimalism, to kind of again point, I mean, and again, it's, I think this is part of what makes it the book, you know, a little kind of twirly in for the reader sometimes, is that I'm intentionally being a bit silly and polemical to kind of say that, like, you know, these things don't, I kind of don't want to do the kind of work that would be required to specify that one person's action was early minimalist and another person's was minimalist, and like there's a hard and fast division between them. So I play with that kind of like same verbiage a lot in the book.
Yeah, thank you for that distinction. I'm also, so along the same lines of the name, I feel like the kind of names of minimalism part comes in as you're kind of talking about the fact that our conception of minimalism and early quote-unquote minimalism in particular comes from that notion of authorship and those collaborations and who was working with who and how those came about, the disputes that happened within those working relationships, and kind of how pedagogically the lore of minimalism has been passed down, and the fact that historiography is the thing that kind of has codified early quote-unquote minimalism as we know it to be, or as we discuss it today, versus as you're talking about the actual aspects of the music itself. So is that kind of where that whole names of minimalism thing kind of comes in?
Yeah, I think, yes. I mean, the most immediate thing is that it's a reference to kind of playing on the book, The Names of History, which is by Jacques Rancière, which is kind of one of the major kind of philosophical reference points for the book. But yeah, a big part of it is just that the kind of book is structured around the disputes that are in the kind of second half of the title, because all those key major like white canonic figures of minimalism, like Lamont Young and Terry Riley and Steve Reich and Philip Glass, were all involved in really close collaboration when they made pretty much all the music that most people know them for. Mm-hmm. But if you, unless you're like super into minimalism and followed into the 80s and 90s, and you're really into like, you know, Reich's Four Sections or Octet or whatever, most of the stuff that they'll know, like Music for 18 and Einstein on the Beach and music in oh my God, I'm blanking on last piece names, Two Pages, those kind of pieces, mm-hmm. or like the early Young and Rally work. Most of that work was made when they were all like collaborating closely, and they kind of like all eventually came into dispute. And kind of part of what I try to argue, especially in, I think, the first chapter, is that like musicologists have taken found a real thrill in dealing with that teleology, because mm-hmm. it kind of lets them have like an allegorical case study in the fact that composers can't write together. Mm. You know, like it kind of like puts composition back in its place by telling you a story of what happens when composers work together. Like they will inevitably come into dispute, is kind of the line of thinking in it. And so that's kind of the major part of a lot of these chapters, or at least kind of like the foreground of each chapter is focused on a dispute between composers. But again, in a really, really, I love kind of like the really surface level things that we kind of either like forget to say or don't want to say or consider too surface to say. But like one of the big kind of touchstones in the dispute between, for example, Steve Reich and Philip Glass is that Reich cannot seem to like go through an interview without talking about how Philip Glass dedicated his piece Two Pages to Steve Reich.
Yeah.
And this kind of whole thing about this back and forth and how he removed the dedication and blah, blah, blah. But like they were all dedicating pieces to one another all the time. And so I kind of get into things like, you know, what's the difference between a dedication versus a kind of subtitle? A lot of these pieces were scored, like my kind of flippant speculative reading of that whole thing is that at that rehearsal, Glass had a bunch of scores that said Two Pages, and he wrote for Steve Reich on one and handed to Steve Reich, and he wrote for John Gibson on one and handed it to John Gibson. And Reich kind of says, I was kind of thinking, you know, that this is all in my archive, and it's not in his archive. There's all kinds of counter things too. Like Reich dedicated several pieces to people that he then removed the dedications for later on. So these all get into kind of the parts of it that I think do sound kind of petty, and that led musicologists for a long time to act as if these recurring disputes in minimalism were like just kind of the result of like interpersonal bickering that it'd be kind of impolite to dig into. And my kind of idea with my dissertation and then with the book was that the frequency of these disputes among these figures is maybe more to be said there. That's something other than just like, you know, digging through their trash cans or something, you know, like mm-hmm. I wasn't trying to be interpersonal about it really at all. Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think I was at least kind of successful in not making it, I hope, petty in terms of, you know, maybe there was a case where one of them just like called the other an asshole or drink sure. something or whatever. And I don't get into that. I don't really care.
Right. But you did. Still, you did use the very technical term of pissing contest in your intro.
But that was like shorthand for like the kind of the, you know, the kind of like macho silliness of all of it, you yes. know, like that's yeah. That, I forgot I wrote that. That was kind of crude, but I think it's funny too. So
no, it's funny because it is also yeah. true. I see what you're yeah. saying though, as far as, again, you're tracking the lineage and the changing definition of what authorship is and what it means to have authorship and ownership over an art object in particular. And kind of to your point, as far as it's self-policing and policed by capital M academic music and policed by audiences, right? The narrative of what a composer is supposed to be and what a composer does. And like you're talking about that it just can't work, that composers can work together. There has to be ownership and authorship in a very particular narrow sense that, again, might not be understood in the moment by the audience or by the historiographer. And then as we get farther and farther away from those events of how it actually occurred, again, the narrative gets codified around kind of the same narrative of a single composer writing a single work in a particular way or whatever. So you're kind of breaking down like what was actually going on there and who influenced who and how that music came to be, and how people are still fighting about it. And yeah, so it was a really fascinating read. I don't think it was petty. I think it was true.
I'm glad. I think, yeah, I appreciate so much that you're summarizing it. Thank you. And I think one of the things I worry that I maybe wasn't explicit enough about is to say, like, I think a lot of what happens in there is like, it kind of shows like the incredible power of what we as musicologists put forward as categories.
Yeah.
I think we like to imagine that it's like, oh, just, you know, we little poor musicologists who have, you know, no impact on things. I think a lot of the way that those composers came towards framing their efforts, to them, they, like me with my guitar playing, they felt some self-consciousness about how much they actually did in that early period. Mm-hmm. And when it came time to, you know, deposit their archives or to talk to musicologists or to do interviews, they really dig back into it and insist, like, I did that, he did that, he never did that, I did that. Like, it gets really, I think it has a lot to do with the kind of like structures that we in our field have set up. I think it's such a recurring problem. And I'm so glad for like a book like Ewell's or a book like Dylan Robinson's Hungry Listening, where like actually thematizing our agentive actions. I think it's such a recurring thing. I don't know if people still say it, but when I was in grad school, it's such a recurring thing that everyone would be like, oh, musicology is so far behind the time on X, Y, Z theoretical things or disciplinary developments in other fields or concepts. And I think at times I always heard that as kind of like an alibi, like we were able to be like, it wasn't that it was true. It was that like we could let it be true if we said it, you know, like if we acted as if we were self-aware about it. I think even Ewell gets into that a little bit too. And he kind of, in that white mythologies chapter, he kind of says how far behind we are classics and stuff. But I think so often we don't give enough credit to the people who are doing the really good work. You know, it's easy to criticize the bad work and then hold ourselves back to it. But I think a lot of good progressive work does happen in the field too. But all to say, I think in my book too, I'm doing sort of that same thing I'm complaining about. It's like, we do make composers, they internalize the kind of cop structures of musicology and hold themselves to them and then narrate themselves the way they think we want to hear what they have to say, or the way that they think we want their career to be narrated, or those kind of things. And so I think that's hopefully a part of the book. It's maybe kind of more of a implied subtexty thing and something I say very much, but I hope it's kind of in there.
No, yeah, I think it's clear. Like it's, you know, we as music academics are creating a narrative and selling a narrative of like undisputed authorship. And they know that. And like Taylor.
Who's they here? like composers?
Composers.
Yeah.
And people creating the art know that is, again, how the narratives will be structured during their lifetimes and after. And so it creates this dynamic that necessitates almost that they would have these arguments in this way and have and try to divide the work equally or try to take credit for XYZ before somebody else can. And so and that being kind of a I don't know if fundamental is the right word, part of minimalism or how it has developed or how we come to think about minimalism is really fascinating.
I hope so. Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably what you were saying and what I was saying. I think it's probably pretty much true of most styles of music. I think what I find exciting and exceptional, and again, not to say it's exceptional, let's avoid the word exceptional. What I find exciting about minimalism that led me to track it is I think there's that whole close relationship to like 60s countercultural, anti-colonial student, whatever kind of levels of revolution. And I think it's really evident, and I kind of cite a lot of historians in other fields in the book about the way that not only like conservative journalists or conservative academics, but even the participants themselves later in their lives kind of recant the efficacy of those kind of moments of revolt. And so I think that's kind of part of the hopefully kind of the political optimism of the book, is that I think like Tony Conrad and Steve Reich, like those two in particular, made a lot of really active, effective, functional, good critiques of compositional authorship in the 60s and 70s that Reich later kind of undermined. Conrad really never did. And that kind of made him a non-figure, I think, in music, more and less. But I think a large part of what minimalism did that made it notable was to actively articulate that critique, practice it in rehearsal and in their careers. But what made it enter, you know, musicology and music history classes was the way it appeared washed of all of those things, as if they were like naive criticisms or petty criticisms or impossible criticisms, or that kind of tone of like composers just can't write together. Like it'll be impossible. Look at Steve Reich. And then Steve Reich is like, yes, composers can't write together. It's impossible.
Yeah.
But it's that kind of tone to me. It's kind of between those two areas of the kind of the effort of a kind of statement of a radical politics, and then the way that it becomes negated or recanted or policed or whatever. And both those in tension kind of constantly.
Okay, well, let's finish up about a conversation about one chapter that I really enjoyed, which was, why didn't I write down the name? Lydia. I'm a professional podcaster.
You want to see how I take notes? There's just like a stack of like individual pages of like legal papers. So I'm not judging.
No, it was the big four chapter. Where is it? Aha, the lessons of minimalism. Three. That's what it's called. Yeah. Okay, so that was a chapter that I found really interesting. I think I understood it, but I would love to just get your kind of breakdown on the dynamics between these four kind of key players and how they, again, speaking to the name of the book, the names of minimalism, so them as these kind of big figures in minimalism, and how their definitions of minimalism, their misunderstandings of minimalism between their collaborators, and how that is affecting this general idea of authorship that you're talking about. So can you break it down for me and the listeners so that I make sure that I understand?
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry that it's maybe a little...
Don't apologize. Listen, I would love to continue to take more time to sit with it. Listeners, buy this book. It's just one of those ones you got to sit with for a couple weeks, and it's great, but it's really fascinating. But yes, I want to make sure that I don't misspeak or misrepresent.
No, thank you. So that chapter, oh my god, it's been a while, is about kind of the dispute between Terry Riley and Steve Reich on the one hand, and then Steve Reich and Philip Glass on the other. Mm-hmm. And it kind of, in the Reich and Glass sense, it kind of relates to their, the two pages for Steve Reich thing I mentioned already earlier, this kind of dispute over, you know, what's a dedication and what's a gift and what's kind of an instrumentation. Like, was Steve Reich the instrumentation of that score, maybe, rather than dedicating?
Interesting.
Those kind of things. But I think as a whole, the thing is about, like, I call it the lessons of minimalism, because it's about the capacity. Oh, it's about It's Gonna Rain. Right.
That's right. I remember listening to that in one, I always talk about this one composition class that I had during my undergrad, which exposed me to a number of like newer pieces of music and modernist music and stuff like that. And I remember listening, and of course, as the only like Black person in class, and I was sitting there like, what is this? What am I hearing?
Do you remember like more than that? Like what your response was or what your thoughts were?
So I remember thinking it was interesting, and I remember stuck out to me a bit more, particularly because we watched this video with a synchronized dance to it, and I thought that was really fascinating, like what it meant to move to this music or dance to this music, so I kind of saw it more through the lens of movement. And that's what kind of stuck out to me. But I remember It's Gonna Rain. I just remember the overwhelming feeling of like, it's weird, but I'm looking around and all my colleagues are just like, yeah, okay. And I was like, And of course my white professor like didn't really say anything about it. And I was like, I don't understand this sample. I don't really understand. Just an overwhelming sense of confusion is what's coming back.
That's super interesting. I mean, yeah, that's kind of, that section on It's Gonna Rain is, I guess, about a lot of things, but I mean, at least one part of it is like, It's Gonna Rain is, I think, I mean, I haven't like done the actual like, you know, word count or page count or paragraph count, but it's probably the most written about like single piece, kind of canonic minimalism.
Yep.
I think because of the kind of complex racial kind of dynamics in play there, that it's the voice of a Black man being sampled and kind of looped and reused, both It's Gonna Rain and Come Out, both are. And the way this is kind of like a recurring feature of early minimal tape music was like the use of like Black voices and Black music as like, you know, and then people start to use kind of metaphors like as raw material or as source material,
right.
Kind of the way these kind of things are then turned into a white compositional frame, which I think is Chip Whitesell's words in that case. But I mean, I kind of just try to get into the fact of like the erasure of that name. So the piece was originally called It's Gonna Rain or Meet Brother Walter in Union Square after listening to Terry Riley. And by the time it was published, Rice just called it It's Gonna Rain. And so again, that's in that case of that piece, there's not only one name, but two names that are erased. And just kind of thinking through, you know, would that piece be different in what critiques we could offer if Brother Walter were given that kind of agency of remaining present, the voice of the preacher you hear and It's Gonna Rain. And it's a totally like surface level, kind of like, you know, not very deep, I don't think very thoughtful question in itself, but to say like, what differently would we be arguing and talking about that piece, It's Gonna Rain, if Reich hadn't removed kind of the actual recognition of the source and the voice and the name of the figure he's working with, as well as kind of the influence of his friend, Terry Riley, who he'd been collaborating with constantly at that point. I think it's a complicated question because, I mean, there's so much of that writing on minimalism and on kind of the critique of the whiteness of it and the use of kind of African music, Black American popular music, Hindustani music, Balinese gamelan, all those kind of sources, that there's really good thoughtful writing kind of stuff. But I was really impressed. I think I kind of ended up rewriting that section in relation to having read Aishon Crawley's The Lonely Letters, where he talks about having first heard Reich and hearing it as like gospel music. And such a wild, I think it kind of felt like really wild to me, because having always learned and known and kind of lived within that mostly white musicological critique of that kind of appropriation, to then hear a Black writer from outside of music studies say that he heard it as like, you know, deeply moving and kind of familiar from his own kind of musical background and performing it for gospel and stuff, felt like it kind of like did my head inside out in one sentence kind of thing, you know?
I'm side-eyeing.
Have you read that book?
No, now I need to read this so that I can investigate.
I think I leave that section pretty kind of close, because I wasn't sure what to say either. I was just kind of trying to say that like the kind of appropriative view we have of it, maybe it would be different if this were different and this were different and this were different, and maybe it'd be more complicated. I think at least one thing is having Brother Walter's name present in the piece, I think would change things. And it's, again, that's almost nothing as an observation, and I admit that, but I think it also has a lot of implications that I hope readers kind of sit with. Mm-hmm. And again, it has to do with, you know, if that name were still on the record,
right,
would that
if it were
changed?
Legit, if it were recognized as a legitimate collaboration, like we'd be talking about it very differently, yes.
Yeah, or as like a field recording. I mean, even before you said, you know, you were in class, like, what is this music? I'm like, is that even music? And I don't mean that in like dismissive, like, you know, that's music and that's not music, but like, is that even music? Like, one of the first chapters too is about Reich's pendulum music, which I'm like, I think if you didn't call it pendulum music, you wouldn't. It's such a funny thing, especially in musicology, where we're like, everything is music. Like, if it's sound, if it's cultural sound, if it's practice, if it's
sound
in the world, if it's
yeah.
speaking and voice and, you know, alarms and sirens, and everything is like, could be heard musically, and it's true, but it's also like, maybe some things just aren't music. And if it's not, what else would we say about it, and how would we read it? And I think maybe there's something in that that's just like, If Reich, at the very least, if Reich had kept Brother Walter's name in place, you wouldn't be able to kind of accuse him of the same erasure of Black presence as people have so many times. And what else would we be able to say about it? I think that's just an interesting problem. So I hope there's more on that in the book, but I forget.
Okay, that's interesting. Like, maybe the idea that it blocks our ability to engage with other parts of it because we are talking about the erasure, and we're talking about, you know, the erasure of recognition, and that it was an actual collaboration. And so if it had been framed differently, like, it almost blocks our ability to engage with it as an art object or as a piece of music, kind of. Is that more or less what you're saying?
Maybe. I don't know. Like, I think that part of the book's a bit vague. I think I kind of leave it like a provocative kind of comment and maybe drop it too much. I should have maybe taken more responsibility for it. I think I mean more that Brother Walter's name is yet one more name that's not conceptually erased in some kind of appropriative sense. It's literally been erased.
Right.
And how different would our writing of and history of minimalism be if we could talk about that as a positive interrelation rather than as an absent erasure?
Yeah.
And I think it's parallel to like removing for Steve Reich from two pages, or to Lamont Young insisting that Tony Conrad didn't do anything. He just happened to be in the room playing the notes he told him to. That there's always so many figures who are present at the scene in this early music.
Mm.
And it's so different than the kind of mindset that they inherited and they refused, but they also got reinscribed into, is this kind of fantasy of someone like sitting at their desk in silence, writing on paper.
Right.
I think minimalism reopened that in such a way that it kind of opened up even what art music meant, or literate music, or whatever you want to call it, meant, you know, Euro-American white literate compositional practice, that it opened that up enough in a lot of ways, but then they all kind of recanted on it and denied it, or said it was impossible, or they were wrong, or they were naive, or whatever.
Mm.
I think Reich being out and recording, you know, Brother Walter's voice and thinking it was interesting is maybe something. It's maybe not just the erasure of a black voice in favor of a white compositional frame. It's maybe something that we could, I think Aishan Crawley kind of frames as a positive. And maybe there is something actually happening there that's worth thinking about rather than chastising.
Yeah. And ain't it just like, you know, white Euro-American art music to constantly create a narrative and recreate a narrative and reify a narrative that music is created in this solitary sense that is devoid of collaboration. There are so many other cultures and musical traditions where collaboration is at the center, and it really seems to be us that continue to kind of latch onto and then retell a history and a narrative of this is how music comes to be, this is how the best music comes to be, and this is how it gets produced, and this is how it gets performed, and it's all this very, you know, it's just a standardized way of going about music, and you're right, it doesn't tell the whole story and doesn't allow for other stories.
I was going to say, I just also don't want to pretend that, I think, I mean, later in the book I get into, you know, a lot of what minimalism is about, like, aspects of, you know, transatlantic kind of black musical popular culture, like repetition and collectivism, and kind of a lot of the things that minimalism does is kind of internalize those kind of aspects and those kind of cultural practices into the art music chronology. So again, none of this is me trying to say that, you know, like minimalism didn't appropriate. I think it's just that like the Brother Walter case seems different. You know, that the voice, that black man's voice that was in your undergrad, your all white undergrad class, you know, is that that would have been probably an anomaly in the case of that class. And it's maybe not the best framing for it or the best means of encountering it. Mm-hmm. And it should have been encountered in other contexts, but it was present. And would it have been different if the name was still, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a weird argument. But I mean, later on in the book, it gets into like the ways in which, I think to me, it's kind of a thing I'm a bit nervous about, because do you know like Julius Eastman's work? He's kind of seen as, you know, the prominent, important black minimalist. There's all this amazing work centering him right now in that kind of discipline. But like, he, you know, was left out of it in his life and died in poverty. And to then pretend he was in the center of it, to me, always feels like, yes, loves music, love his life, interesting guy, make him part of the thing. But to let it kind of, I'm always worried about letting kind of things like revive minimalism, which was always definitively in its time a very white thing, of a very white kind of appropriation of a lot of the most, you know, well-known kind of features of what black popular culture was about musically in America. Like Lamont Young was just like sitting in Fluxus concerts playing blues progressions for hours.
Mm.
And everyone was like, oh, what an innovator, what a rebel. And
yeah,
like, if that had been like Ornette Coleman, who would have been around at those same shows and on those same blocks, would he have been treated as a radical and innovator, or would he have been asked to stop playing blues progressions over and over and over and over and over?
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I'm always just really attentive and nervous about trying to let kind of like saggy, dying old discourses or labels or genres kind of become revived when maybe just something else is happening. Maybe it's not the same thing renewed, it's something different, a few feet away or separate or whatever.
And that's why I love the distinctions that you're making throughout the book of early minimalism versus capital M minimalism and kind of those small distinctions there, because there's obviously whenever you slap the term early on something, right, there are connotations to that. And a big connotation to that now is we are assuming that early minimalism was this, you know, less complicated, primitive kind of version of what we have now, and then the opposite implication is that we are existing with a more evolved version of minimalism that is devoid of these, you know, kind of appropriative issues that you're talking about, or that we've and now that we've, you know, taken steps to try and include, you know, people of color in minimalism who were doing minimalism at the time and who are doing it now and all that stuff, that erases kind of the problematic past of this music. And so I appreciate that you kind of make the distinction of how reductive that kind of label of early can be and how it's imbued with a lot of things that you kind of pull apart, I think.
I hope so. Yeah, thank you. I think to me, one of the lines I really enjoyed in the very early pages of the Yule book is about kind of the only thing worse than the erasure of Black presence is kind of the erasure of anti-Black racism. And I feel like a lot, that's kind of just my anxiety, is that a lot of the kind of, you know, keep the same structure and add new voices risks a lot of like just making the discipline or making the genre more palatable again. And I think there's hopefully ways of doing both, like, you know, adding the new presences, but also not pretending it was something to feed the old vampire, whatever the metaphor here is. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, this kind of thing is, I think, running through it. I mean the book mostly to be kind of a critique of like the white fantasy of authorship as it appears in, as it's kind of recuperated in minimalism from kind of the 80s to now. Like it's still an ongoing thing. Like I think some things, I think, you know, don't need to be like carried on and updated over and over and over. They should be kind of like allowed to fail and die.
Yes. No. Don't even get me started on opera. I have so many operas where I'm like, we can just retire that one. We don't have to keep doing Madame Butterfly. I'm sorry. The music is beautiful. Oh, yeah? I'm sorry, but we don't have to keep doing it. So there are some, yeah, that I would agree that we can retire and continue to study and continue to talk about. We have recordings, but like, do the discourses need to live, you know? Yeah,
that fear of loss is, I think, really pervasive. I think it's really like, again, it's one of those things that's just totally at the heart and like unspoken of what we think that we do in academia or in like museum studies or whatever. You know, it's kind of whole things of kind of a lot of my kind of newer research is around like museum things and repatriations and rematriations of sound and art and stuff. And like just that whole kind of, you know, one of the least racist lines of argument in things like repatriation of Benin bronzes is like, aren't you glad we kept them safe? And it's like, that's pretty messed up argument to begin from. Like, and that's, again, that's kind of, you know, the thoughtful, open-minded curatorial angle often, but it's like, you can't have that argument without all the dispossession and the violence and the gunboats and the viciousness and the theft and the plundering. I think this is kind of the case, is that just there's a real anxiety around letting anything die. And maybe some things should die. And not to say that's, you know, the artifacts in that case, it's like the structures that insist that they are benevolent and present and offering ongoing life. Part of the project is kind of around like museum work, and a lot of, you know, a lot of Indigenous folks refer to like museum things as being kind of all kept on life support, like kind of, you know, well beyond their lifetime and being kind of incarcerated in museums doing cultural work for people they're not meant to be performing for centuries beyond their natural lifespan. And so I guess that kind of, you know, thinking has become important to me.
Yeah, totally.
When I say letting things die, I don't think we just let stuff die. That sounds cold and cruel.
No, you know what I mean?
Like some stuff.
But I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Some stuff ends. I would agree with that. There are ways of knowing and art objects and knowledge that we feel entitled to and feel entitled to keep and feel entitled to hoard, right? That's a real, obviously, colonialist impulse, right? And so that we in the West in particular feel. And so learning to let go of the idea that you are entitled to certain kinds of knowledge, entitled to certain kinds of objects, entitled to certain art, forever and ever, amen. But that, what would a life cycle look like for those things? Things that, what does it mean for us as a field or us as people collectively to outgrow something? And what does it mean to make space for new music and new discourses and new, right? Like for us to move forward. We don't know how to have that conversation, really.
I wonder, yeah, you don't think we do in general?
Do we? I don't know.
I think this is one of those moments where you could say we don't. I think there is. I think it's forming. I think a lot of really solid people who, and you know, mostly Indigenous folks, I think of, but like Dylan Robinson's work, and then several folks who like aren't in musicology but have strong musicological backgrounds, like Robin Gray and Trevor Reed, are writing all this kind of stuff right now, and Jessica Bissett Perea, who is an ethnomusicologist, like about this kind of thing of, you know, like what do these kind of things turn into if you don't let elements of the culture recede and vanish and kind of fertilize the future of the thing, you maybe have some kind of weird vampire culture, which is maybe what, you know, white Euro-American settler coloniality has been and is and keeps being. I'm doing a paper at the AMS. I can do a plug now too. I'm doing a paper at the AMS that's called How Music Renders Property. That's kind of about this new work I'm doing, and around some kind of lines too, like what happens when you think of the music we engage with as you know, an actual thing, and a thing that we've at some point enclosed and delimited into a precise location through scores or recording or copyright or music curriculum or whatever. And what happens when we then like start like buying and selling and trading and repatriating those? Like, how do they keep the same shape or do they change? Like, and so this is kind of the direction myself's been in recently, where it's questions of like Dylan Robinson's written about, that work's still forthcoming. It's coming out soon. There's about this kind of the Canadian opera, Louis Riel, which has a Niska, which is a Western Canadian, British Columbia First Nation, has like a morning song that his composer had on a recording from 1927 and that he then had transcribed and published. And then this composer in the 60s used it as an example of Métis song, which is like central kind of Plains Canada Indigenous community. And the Nisga community, now that they're aware of it, thanks to Dylan bringing it to their attention, have asked that be removed from the opera, that particular aria. And so they have now commissioned a Métis composer to write a kind of replacement. But one of the claims they're making is they want all the copies of the record and the DVD and the score and the CD and whatever else all returned, as part of a gesture of, you know, repair. And I think that kind of thing calls the whole like musicological, ontological bluff in a super hard way, because every musicologist would say you could remove every single physical instantiation of the thing and it won't cease to exist. But then like, cool, then burn them all, give them all back. But, you know, it's a really strong way, I think, of calling that kind of bluff, to be like, if it's not real, then, you know, go tear that page out of the score in your library, gather the DVDs and the LPs, send them to
Nisga. Yeah, it shouldn't matter anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, it shouldn't matter. Your ontology says, our ontology says, you know, like, that's not the thing. So burn it. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't hold very well. So that's kind of the direction of my AMS paper, is kind of from all that work and all those cases where, you know, music has been stolen and needs to be returned. What are you returning? How could you possibly? And of course you have to. And so again, I'm already going to fall into the kind of the really complicated discursive loops I fall into, where it's like, yes, you have to, but how could you possibly? And now do it.
Yes.
You know, like, this is why my writing is complicated.
As brilliant. Yeah. Everybody, please make sure you check out The Names of Minimalism. I'll put the link for everything that we've mentioned in the show notes. Patrick, is there anything else that you want to mention that you're working on or anything that listeners should know about? Come see his talk at AMS.
Yeah, come see my talk at AMS. It's called How Music Renders Property. Don't know when it'll be yet. But yeah, so that's the one. And then the thing I mentioned of Dylan's that I let me make sure with you before this goes out that we co-wrote an essay called The Feeling of Knowing Music. That's going to be in Duke University Press is doing a new version of their Affect Theory Reader. So it's called the Affect Theory Reader 2. And Dylan and I wrote this essay called The Feeling of Knowing Music. So it has to do with that kind of thing of, you know, what does your kind of epistemological knowledge of music bring you to treat it as? And a lot of the essay is about kind of, you know, like writing about music type guides, where it's like, you could be in a band and have a massive record collection and be involved in community choirs forever. And that does not, you know, that does not validate you thinking you can write about music. That's kind of the tone and the actual statement of a lot of those kind of writing about music type guides. So a lot of it for us is kind of saying that a big part of what musicology is and has been to make something that people really, really love and hold very intimately and know very, very well into a kind of alien, unfamiliar thing. So a big part of what our writing tends to do is like dispossess people of a relationship that they hold quite dear, which again, to me feels familiar. I think when I first started reading books on minimalism, I mean, they're all wonderful. I love them now, but as like, you know, an undergrad, I was like, what are they talking about? Like, I think there's a real sense when people approach you what, sorry?
I meant me when I was reading this book. I was like, okay.
Oh, this book too. Yeah, I know. I say all these things and then I write like
listeners
that.
Listeners know it is good. It is good. Read the book.
Yeah, I like to let things spiral in a kind of conversational way. And I think when you're reading on a page, you can get a little tongue twisty.
You should start a podcast. I would love to listen to it.
I did one, not a new podcast. I made a course that was like a podcast. Like students had a 2-hour with all the listening in it and all the lecture in it. That was during the pandemic. So that was, again, in collaboration with Dylan, we did this class called Listening Otherwise, where they had 2 hours a week of like a podcast that had all their audio examples and the whole lecture and lots of assignments. And like, we'd say, pause it and go listen to something. And then we'd meet for an hour, we can talk about it. So we keep talking about maybe making that into just a podcast. It would just need lots of editing. A lot of it's just like depressed, like COVID lockdown reflection.
But that sounds so fun. What a fun pedagogical tool that your students got to experience.
Yeah, I wish I could use it now. I think now it would just feel kind of like, you know, maybe a bit lazy to do that, like to make, I wouldn't need to do anything. But no, one day again. But yeah, so I don't know, what am I working on? Yeah, that, and I'm doing this AMS paper and I'm trying to write a new book kind of on this dispossessive return rematriation kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But that's very, very, very early stages. So the AMS paper is kind of a first effort to talk about that kind of stuff in public, which will be fun. I have a radio show, which is going to happen in a little bit. So me and my friend Brian do a show called What Do We Know? That's like on CJSR campus radio in Edmonton. It's every Monday. And it's not like CV line kind of work, but it's like a thing we really enjoy. We kind of like, it gets us, we're kind of thinking about it as, you know, a space for the music department on campus radio, mm-hmm. which I think every music programs probably have a show on campus radio. I think I would now say that and believe that. I think most often they don't. But, you know, the faculty or somebody should be claiming some of that airtime and public time for like public work in the local region, I think.
And that is going to do it for this episode of the podcast. Thank you so much to Dr. Patrick Nicholson for being on the show. It was such a thought-provoking conversation, and I'm always so thankful for the opportunity to hear about music that I personally know nothing about. And now I have a cool new book on my shelf. Make sure you check out The Names of Minimalism through the University of Michigan Press. Go Blue! The links to all the books that we mentioned today are in the show notes. If you, dear listener, want to get involved with the show, if you want to send me feedback about the show or suggest a guest or a topic for the show, if you're a musician and you want to be on the show yourself, please tell me about what you do in music. Send me your books, send me your songs. I would love to see them. You can send me an email at hermusicacademia@gmail.com or go to my website, hermusicacademia.com, fill out the contact form there. Always looking to make more musical connections. Until next time, thanks for listening.